listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer in residence. We're joined today by Dr. Lynn Wells and Chris Meisner. Lynn Wells is an Avasant advisor with more than 20 years of senior civilian leadership experience with the U.S. government in national security affairs, including service as acting Secretary of Defense for Networks and Information Integration, and Department of Defense Chief Information Officer. Chris Meisner is a senior associate at Avasant, and he has extensive experience working on federal market IT and technology innovation. Lynn and Chris, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So for all that's been written about autonomy and autonomous systems and their impact on warfare, it feels like one of the most decisive uses in the 21st century is actually going to be in the cyber domain. And Lynn, given your background, I'd love to talk a little bit about how you see autonomy taking shape in the cyber context.
Well, I think there's been a lot of work written, a lot of words written about kind of autonomy in motion, which is to say drones and autonomous weapon systems and things like that. But one of the very important things that came out for me, especially this year at the Cyber Grand Challenge at the DEF CON Hacker Convention, was the importance of autonomy at rest, essentially autonomy in cyber environments. And the point here is how machines can autonomously attack, if you will, other machines, and then use the sensors, their own sensors, and the sensors in the network to sense the type of attack that's being launched back against them, counter autonomy, if you will, and operate in that space. And just because in the future, cyber, if you look at the so-called OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, act loop, the observe and orient increasingly is being done with electromagnetic systems, and the decide, act is supported by decision support systems. Cyber, in many respects, trumps other types of areas in both land, sea, air, and space domains. So I think this is going to be very important.
When you start looking at counter-autonomy, it sounds like what we're going to be seeing, or not seeing is the case maybe since it's cyber, is machine versus machine. And I have to imagine that is going to take place at such speed that keeping a human in the loop is going to be increasingly difficult.
The Air Force has been talking for some time about man on the loop rather than man in the loop. And the point here is just if you wait for the picture of the network to turn from green to yellow to red before you decide to act, then it's too late. So the man on the loop really is giving a set of rules to the machines within which it can act. And then the man only gets involved either to set the rules or if the situation moves outside the boundaries, the rules have been set. That's what man on the loop means. At the same time, the autonomy really differs from automatic in that automatic machines only can do what they've exactly been told, whereas autonomous have a certain latitude to make decisions within the rule sets they've been given. So I think you're going to see the machines have a certain latitude to do that because of the velocity of the engagement. The people will have to have delegated certain rule sets to them, and then the man on the loop becomes the decision maker when the conditions move outside the rules that have been set.
Yeah, you know, August, I actually think there's a pretty interesting industry perspective here as well. If you look at where the defense contractors and also the commercial players that are serving the Department of Defense, as well as federal civilian agencies, and frankly, a lot of the commercial entities as well that also need cyber protection, if you look at where the innovation dollars are right now, very few of these entities are investing in autonomy from a cyber perspective. And I think part of that is that there's been a maturation of the technology, and I think we still have a ways to go to make sure that we have mature autonomy that is available for the cyber mission writ large. But I think something that's going to be very interesting to watch over the next few years is how this actually makes its way into the S&T plans, not just of the government, but also of the contractor community that supports it as well. And I worry to some extent because there is an issue here around not just demand, but also around authorities to be able to procure these kind of systems in the first place. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch industry's response to this in the coming years.
Chris, to follow up on that, do you see some of this having to come from the private sector first, be it traditional contractors or Silicon Valley, or do you feel like there's enough of a demand signal on the government side with a lot of the conversation around third offset and other kind of game-changing capabilities?
Yeah, it's a great question, and in terms of the origin and supply, or I should say the supply and the demand dynamics, a lot of the supply for autonomy and AI capabilities resides in the private sector, and so I think Silicon Valley has a large role to play in that. Not too much of it has found its way into security yet, but I think that might be coming. In terms of the demand side, though, I think that's really where the government has a really large role to play, frankly. These kinds of over-the-horizon innovations are ripe for the Department of Defense and the government writ large that has a bit more of a long-term view in terms of investment horizon and is willing to be an early adopter of capabilities that are not quite mature. For all the hype that Silicon Valley gets for being innovative, a lot of the innovation we see tends to be incremental innovation. And some of the really truly game-changing stuff happens in government, and because I think they have some interesting needs that, frankly, deserve a different kind of investment horizon in terms of maturing technology.
But if I
So.
could follow up on that too, I think one of the things that's very important in this is that the requirements for these capabilities from the government need to find their way into the various documents that by which programs are kind of defined and budgeted and then tested. And so part of the problem right now is there's very little incentive on the part of the government for a company to come in and say, I have developed a much more resilient cyber system and or autonomous cyber system, so this brings you capability. So the test and evaluation people have a plan that says, was it written in here? And the program manager has a budget that says, how do I budget for it? So a very important thing that's just getting started now is this system survivability key performance parameter, which is being used as the basis to put cybersecurity in the requirements documents, which means it then gets in the budget documents, which again gets in the test documents. So I absolutely agree that DoD can have a role in looking out over the horizon and doing this, but it has to be accompanied by the appropriate documentation to make sure that the contractors get rewarded for adding these capabilities into their proposals.
Does having this kind of capability necessarily mean that cyber is going to start costing more, or is this the sort of investment that reduces costs over a medium to longer term? Because I feel like that upfront versus medium to long term investment paradox is often a bit of a trap when it comes to investing in such technologies.
So I think the issue is if you make these investments and sort of evaluate them, test for them early in the process, then they can be relatively low cost, or maybe even cost reduction type adds. If you then try to go in after the system is nearing its final operational test and evaluation and re-engineer them back into the system, they're enormously expensive. So this is kind of a buy smart question. But it's also, as you, again, if I were evaluating proposals on a life cycle basis, I'd sort of recognize that this one has significant economic advantage because I'm getting involved early versus this one's going to have to be retrofitted later.
Yeah, and I'd say in the long term, August, it should reduce the cost of security. The more you can automate, as we've seen with other technology markets and in particular information technology markets, the more you can automate, the more you can drive down costs. But I think there's actually a more important question than just what the cost side of it is. And that's, for the last decade, we've talked a lot about shortages in skilled cyber warriors, skilled cyber labor. And it's hard to train, it's hard to identify, it's hard to keep these kind of people, particularly for the government, but I think writ large across the economy. And so if we don't figure out how to make autonomy work in security, we're going to continue to have these sort of people-based shortages in terms of cybersecurity. And so I think it's actually more important than cost. I think it's just about capability in the fact that we're just not going to have enough people to do the job. We still don't have enough people to do the job. So we need to get autonomy into the game to help out.
Lynn, from your experience at DEF CON and Black Hat this summer, You obviously had a chance to see some of the DARPA competition and competitors in action. What were some of your takeaways from that for those that weren't actually able to get out to see those?
Well, so the most dramatic was DARPA's Cyber Grand Challenge, which was a very expensive, I think it was like $50-odd million project over several years to actually have a series of computers, seven finally, which have been culled from a group of about 100, that were conducting essentially an autonomous capture the flag exercise against each other. But what was really interesting to me is the combination of what was used there, the artificial intelligence, machine learning, plus a focus of security operations at the binary level and pre-execution environments, plus use of what's called formally verified code, which is actually code that can be mathematically verified to be secure, plus things like big data analytics to detect anomalous behavior, sort of caused the DARPA director, as she put it, to imagine the future with some likelihood of cybersecurity. I mean, that's a pretty dramatic statement. It's still well in the future, a lot of work, and we needed to achieve it, but that's really one of the first times I've come away from a black hat computer security conference or a DEF CON hacker convention with a sense of optimism.
You know, from a layperson's perspective, you know, the notion of a likelihood of cybersecurity is somewhat frightening, because I think a lot of people actually assume that we're closer to that, and yet the more you know about cybersecurity, the more you realize how far off that is. What kind of time horizon do you think we're realistically looking at, particularly as we start seeing autonomy change the way we do cyber, both defense but also even offense?
Well, one thing to look back on is DARPA has a number of these grand challenges they've done over time. And one of the most currently relevant was the one they did, I believe, in 2004-05, which was to test self-driving vehicles. And it took an awful lot of work to get the self-driving vehicle to meet the challenge. But now, 11 years later, roughly, you're seeing the beginnings of the self-driving taxi services in Singapore. You're seeing the potential for an awful lot of either partially self-driving or fully self-driving vehicles. So in this case, you're talking about a decade. I would think you're probably talking about that much time here. And at that time, the computers that ran the Cyber Grand Challenge today will be seen to be just hopelessly out of date. But this is the beginning of a process that is only going to accelerate. And certainly you look at the enormous amount of investments in artificial intelligence and machine learning, most of which now in the private sector, is that this can be brought along not just with Defense Department spending, but to the extent that the private sector sees it valuable, it can move the ball down the field. But I would think we're talking something on the order of a decade out.
Chris, from an industry perspective, on the pacing of those advances in the commercial market, how do you see that dynamic playing out in terms of trying to keep ahead of a company like Facebook or Google, or is it better to be a fast follower? I mean, what is your kind of strategic take on that?
So in terms of industry investment, we are in a nascent enough stage for the technology that I'm not sure we even have a first mover yet, certainly not at any scale. And to circle back to the comment Lynn said, I think the pacing for previous Cyber Grand Challenges is one good way to look at it in terms of about a decade, 15 years before we see some of these technologies coming online at scale in terms of cyber autonomy. But the one thing that maybe gives me a little bit more hope in terms of some near term efforts is, the cybersecurity market is segmented in a fairly fragmented manner, and there may be applications, not necessarily at the highest end, but perhaps getting closer to compliance and accreditation activities, or something maybe just above that in terms of level of sophistication of the analysis or the automation, where we might be able to see autonomy working its way into the cybersecurity market in some of these more incremental ways. But I agree with Lynn that when we really see cyber working at scale in a sort of a grand challenge, capture the flag kind of environment, we're probably about 10 years off from that.
And I would just like to reinforce there, Chris says, because where this is likely to be applied first are in those systems where there's a compelling need for really high-end security. I mean, it's going to be a long time, I think, before you get the Internet of Things with the myriad sensors and inexpensive devices that are out there to have any kind of a level of security like this. And this, I think, is a major cause for concern, or should be for all of us, about just how much insecurity there is in that. At the same time, one could imagine targeting some very high-end, not just high-end, very critical systems that would need that kind of protection, and making progress faster.
Yeah, the threat that, you know, a DDoS attack from a series of DVRs or toasters or whatever household device, you know, seems to be, you know, part of the technology landscape, with very little likelihood of a kind of organized response, at least at this point. And that actually leads me to a kind of a notion of how much we can trust in some of the systems that we're developing. And Lynn, can you talk a little bit about how we can begin to test and vet systems and also see them used in a more kind of holistic environment than in current kind of operating environments are allowing us to do from the traditional test and evaluation community?
Yeah, just touching briefly on Internet of Things, I read an article by someone the other day who said he wakes up in the morning, goes into the kitchen with his cup of coffee, and wonders what criminal activity his refrigerator has been up to overnight. So with regard to the testing here, I think, you know, a lot of systems, Aegis, for example, for the Navy's Aegis weapon systems support air defense, have built-in test modules that test them very well in terms of how well the systems are meeting various incendiary parameters. I don't believe that those now test for cybersecurity. And it seems to me that this is something where one could make some pretty good progress fairly quickly by building into the embedded test modules for some of our more important systems something that says, not only am I ready to fire the missile, but am I have been degraded in some way from my cybersecurity baseline and need to be fixed. So that's an area I think could be profitably explored quickly.
Chris, do you have any thoughts as well on the kind of testing of autonomous systems, and again, being able to create almost space for both experimentation but also verification? Because it would seem like there is a need for both as we start to think about autonomy.
So the verification, I mean, again, part of the problem here is going to be the velocity of change, the capability. And if you have a test plan, for example, that establishes through these various processes the cybersecurity endorsements on the engineering change proposals, this kind of thing, that says here's a baseline to which you should test. But the technology is changing so fast that, for example, if you're changing some parameter like computing power being the cost every 18 months, in a year and a half, you have 100% more capability, but in 5 years, 900%, and by 10 years, it's 10,000% capability. By 2030, it's 100,000%. Now, here that may go up, it may go down, it may fluctuate, but the point is linear projections of where we are today cannot possibly work. And so you have to design the test plans in ways that they can evolve as well. So what you test for today, it has to be built in that says, okay, we're going to look for something more sophisticated at some spiral. You can't just do it continuously. So I think that kind of thinking needs to be built into the testing process as well.
Well, Lynn and Chris, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us, August.
With Avasense on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Avasense on the Record. To learn more about Avasense, go to avasense.com or follow us on Twitter at @avasense.